We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. I am Mark. And I am on with Kim. How are you doing, Kim?
Oh, I'm doing great, thanks. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing really well.
Good.
Now, even though this episode will air a little bit more in the future of when we're recording it, autumn has begun, and I'm going to say it's your favorite season as well as it is mine.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so I'm right. It's like, don't order for me, sir! One of the reasons why I chose this particular episode is because it started with Ghostbusters. Not the Ghostbusters, the movie. It is talking about ghost hunters, I guess. That's the phenomenon that this kind of started out. And this is a really early depiction of it. But the episode we're talking about today aired in October 1994, which is just really perfect. And it's season 7, episode 2. And we're going to be covering Ghostbusters, Rubas, Dead or Alive, Elysian Park Treasure, Soldier Alexander, and an update to the family that spent quite a number of nights in prison or jail. So this brings us originally to New Mexico, Santa Fe. I've never been.
Me neither.
But I always like the architecture. And
it's beautiful. Yeah,
it brings us to a beautiful 136-year-old Victorian mansion. And there is very often, when you have an old house or bed and breakfast or building like this, one of the best things, if you really want to bring in a new audience, if you want to bring in a lot of people who want to make reservations, there's nothing better than either some really creepy lore or a legitimate haunting. And that's kind of where we are with this.
Yeah, especially with this kind of Unsolved Mysteries audience, like, that's how you're going to sell it. This whole thing felt like a paid commercial by Marriott, because Marriott's ultimately who owns the La Posada Hotel. But it's weird because we start with this mansion, like you said, 136-year-old mansion, and then they just built the hotel around it. So in the middle of the hotel is just this mansion. It's so bizarre.
But you found out that you can actually book the rooms in the mansion?
Yeah, you can book the Julia's room. They tell us that on Unsolved Mysteries. I tried to see how much it would cost to book it online, and it looks like it is under construction and it is unavailable currently to rent her room out.
But if you do want to stay at the La Posada, is that it?
La Posada.
La Posada. I don't know what that means.
Me neither. I should have looked that up. No, I
We just thought of that. But it cost about $179 a night, which seems to be the going cost right now. We just booked a couple nights away in a couple weeks or in a week. And the prices seem to have jumped about 30% from this whole coronavirus thing. So, but we're looking forward to a very clean experience. And I'm sure, and the reviews at the La Posada are pretty good. They say that's
Posada,
very clean.
Posada.
Whatever. I'm probably saying something really terrible, right?
By the way, I just looked it up. It means the inn, so it's perfect.
All right. Well, the inn, I'll call it.
Okay.
So the La Posada.
There you go.
Sorry. But it does look like a beautiful home. It looks as though the home was built with really no budget in mind. It was just, let's build this. And
yeah, very fancy. They said it was like the first mansion that was ever in New Mexico. But like you were saying about the hotel being fancy and clean, I mean, I was looking at their restaurant. They have like James Beard award-winning chefs, and like it looks pretty fancy.
Now, I found this one little thing. from a Jewish website called Jewish Ghost Story. And I just want to read it real quick. It gives you an idea of what New Mexico was like when they arrived. The couple arrived in early 1866 to a place of flat adobe buildings randomly arranged around a dirt plaza at the center of town. Streets were piled with garbage. This was the rough west, where parties in the local dirt floor dance hall often ended in gunfire. Julia, who we will discuss in just a moment, spoke neither English nor Spanish. There were few German speakers and even fewer Jews. So this was like Little House in the Prairie for immigrants from Germany, really.
Yeah, I looked it up, and the earliest record I could get was 1899, but there was 2,000 Jewish people in New Mexico. And currently,
that's a lot, actually.
Well, I mean, I guess you're right. Out of probably like 20,000 people in the whole state at that time. But nowadays, the Jewish population down in New Mexico is 0.6%, which actually isn't even the lowest.
Listen, I wanted to announce it. I'm bringing the Jews back to New Mexico.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I'm going to open my own shul. And I'm going to have my own sect of Judaism called Marxism. No.
Oh, well, that's a different thing. But yeah. As Abraham Staub said to the house, Mazel Tov.
Oh, man. Mazel Tov. What? Yeah, I think that was a very strange thing to just say. I don't know. I don't know what that was all about. But it looked as though they were coming home. There's a number of things they could have said, but maybe Mazel, I call it Mazel Tov, but around the boardroom. But Mazel Tov, maybe it's one of those things that everybody's like, oh, I guess they're Jewish. Because as soon as he said it, I said, oh, I didn't realize they were Jewish.
Yeah, I picture Robert Stack smoking a cigarette being like, yeah, put one of those weird Jewy phrases in there.
Just throw it in anywhere. I don't know.
But yeah, so she moved from Germany and she comes to marry this like richy rich guy, Abraham Staub, in 1870. And he was actually a major supply contractor for the U.S. Army during, Civil War, which is kind of a silly thing to say because they were both the U.S. Army. So I'm not sure who he's talking about.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I couldn't find exactly where his money came from. There are people who are still around that are related to him, of course. They had so many kids, but on that, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes, but, you can read a little bit about the people who are still around and they talk about the history. And that's the thing I read was actually written, I believe, by somebody who interviewed an ancestor or ancestor.
Yeah. Well, like you said, they had a ton of kids. In 1884, they and their seven kids moved into the mansion that Abraham had been building for them. And this place was fancy.
That, I mean, it is beautiful. He's talking about the rose glass. Is that a big deal? I don't know.
Yeah, he had like this rose stained glass of a rose because a rose was Julia's favorite flower.
And that does come up later. I was thinking, I'm sorry. You know what? That totally went over my head because I thought it was rose-colored glass, and it didn't make a connection until later. Damn it! I'm letting everyone down, including you. And
it's okay. We'll get through it.
You know who would have corrected me right on the spot, right after you did, actually, is Betsy Solit, who's a local folklorist.
Yeah, she kind of comes on Unsolved Mysteries to tell us all about how they went through. This was like the place to be in the 1800s. They would like have parties with dignitaries and just a very, very fancy place. Soon after, Julia and Abraham actually welcomed an eighth baby who sadly died very soon after birth.
Do we know how old she was at this point? Because I couldn't find a specific age, but I'm guessing late 30s.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how old she was. I do know, I don't even know exactly what number child this was. Unsolved Mysteries tells us it's baby number 8. I found a few websites that said this was baby number 7.
Yeah, me too.
But I'm not exactly sure what happens. But, you know, you kind of alluded to in our notes, this kind of thing seemed to have happened a lot back then. You wouldn't think it would necessarily be, like, as devastating a blow. I'm sure the infant mortality rates were pretty high.
Especially in New Mexico. I mean, I'm just imagining that they're not going to have the best sanitary conditions, even though they have the money and they have the means to do these things. It doesn't mean that your water is as clean as it could be.
Sure. Yeah. And who knows how long it would have taken a doctor to get there. Like, I just got the feeling this was kind of an underdeveloped place. But
you think they had a Doc Baker in town?
I bet they did. I bet they did. Well, the rich people did, no doubt. But
there's no doubt that this child perished then.
Yeah. Well, she actually, they definitely didn't have a psychologist because she, like, didn't eat, didn't sleep. She was so distraught over the death of this child that she, her whole head turned gray, like her hair was all gray, and she never left the room. So
did you know even that's real? Now. Like, that actually happens?
Yeah.
You know, I never knew that you can legitimately have so much stress that your hair turns white.
Yeah, even kids, like if they're in like a car accident or something, their hair can turn white.
Now, my hair, just when I first bought this house, it was an extremely stressful thing because we were buying it during Hurricane Sandy. So it was an extremely stressful time for, I'd say, 3 months. And my hair turned very gray. And I was like, all right, maybe I'm just getting older. I was, you know, I think I was like 40, almost 40 at that time. And over the past several years, my hair went back to black. Which is just strange. Now, I still have grays, but not nearly what I had back then. So I just thought, I don't know. With me anyway, it goes back and forth. Because I'm not a very, I deal with stress very well, I think. And I don't, I got really stressed then.
It was a period.
Yeah, so I thought it was just something that was a fluke. But I did look it up. And again, we'll put this link in the show notes. But science confirms it. Stress can make your hair turn gray.
Yeah, and sadly, Julia never really seemed to recover very much. She died in 1896 at the age of 52. In the early 1900s, one of the ballrooms on the third floor, this is how fancy this place is, was destroyed by fire, and Abraham Staub died in 1913. So in 1936, the mansion was acquired by La Posada, and the hotel was built around it.
Yeah, and like you said, the whole thing does feel a little bit like an ad for the La Posada, and but it kind of makes me also think, if I was going through New Mexico, I might stop there and check it out. It seems, I'd love to see the old, you know, mansion. I don't care so much about La Posada.
Maybe
the food is good, though. You did take a look at the menu.
I mean, they're really leaning into it. Like, their bar is like, oh, Julia's spirited bar and all that. So they're really leaning into the whole there's a ghost here thing. But we meet father and son security guard team, Chuck and John Barone. And Chuck says that he feels like an energy or a spirit in that place. In 1991, he gave a tour of the house, of the Staub house. And he knocked on Julia's door because when you work at a hotel, you can't enter any door without knocking on it. And they said that it was unoccupied, but they distinctly heard a woman say, like, I'm in here. And so they did end up opening it after a while. And the room wasn't booked. There was nobody in the room. The windows were locked. Like, there was no way a person was in there, basically.
Wow. That would freak me out right away. But I don't know, when I see them really pushing it these days, I'm hoping that it's not like a fraud. It's not just like an activated type of thing where it hears a knock and it plays a recording.
I know. I really feel like they're trying so hard, honestly, but we do meet Ross Weissenhofer and Holly Knorr, who are hotel guests who claim to have had a run-in with Ghost Julia. So they stayed in the room across from Julia's, and Ross says he's trying to fall asleep and he feels someone staring at him. And so he opens his eyes and sees a white apparition staring at him. And he is like, Holly, we have got to check out. Like, we got to go. I don't like the evil in here. And I looked them up and they got married and they had a few kids. So that's nice. Yeah,
so that's really sweet. I thought that Holly was taking it a little bit lighter than Ross, or maybe she was just had those, the same stupid grin I would have in front of a camera where it's like, it was scary. And I'm like smiling. Yeah. But I really thought she was having more fun with it than he was.
And like, they never really said if she saw the ghost or not. So maybe she's more like this wacky guy or, you know, I don't know. But 2 weeks later, they actually talked to Christopher Chacon, who is this guy who is the quote unquote ghostbuster. He is like the paranormal investigator for this episode. So they undergo all these like psychological, physical evaluations.
Like, it's crazy because it's like, we're trying to spend a romantic weekend.
I know, exactly. And they're like, nope. And so they took like air samples, water samples. They set up equipment to check magnetic fields. And just, I will say, I thought they were very thorough.
You know, I think they state that it was $500,000 worth of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is equipment that has become very popular with the entire birth of the paranormal investigator movement, I'll call it. Mm-hmm. And they were using FLIR cameras, which are F-L-I-R, which basically senses heat changes. Electricians and plumbers use this to determine, like, if water is flowing and consistent and insulation is correct. But, you know, that was the original, reason to have these type of things. But so they look for cold spots. That seems to be one of those things. But back then, I don't know how much they were, but I'm sure that they were several thousand dollars. Now you can pick one up on Amazon for about $500 that records on a little SD card. And their computers, of course, were archaic for the time and huge.
Oh, they took up like half the hotel room.
Right. And it's like you see in the corner the guy playing Doom or something. but yeah, they had so much equipment that for the most part, in all legitimacy, not legitimacy, but in all reality, our phones probably have all of that technology built in for the most part.
Probably, yeah. But, you know, a fun little note that I loved that we ended on was if you do stay there, you are supposed to bring a red rose and leave it on the windowsill as kind of like an offering for Julia. And it seems like that way she'll leave you alone. Although I wouldn't.
That's sweet.
I think that's nice, but I wouldn't say she's like a mean spirit or even mischievous or anything. She seems to just be a voyeur. So I don't know why you would not want her there. If I'm booking this hotel, I am not putting a rose out. Like, I want to see her.
You know, and to be critical to Unsolved Mysteries, they only gave, what, two examples?
Yeah.
You know,
well, I don't know.
Not enough. I don't recall there being any other examples.
Yeah, no, I mean, they had the Ross and they had her, but I will say I was very impressed by the thoroughness of Christopher Chacon, because I kind of roll my eyes a little bit when I see, like, paranormal investigator, and he's, like, got the eyebrows. I know, sorry, no disrespect to what we do here, but I looked him up online. He's also listed as, like, a magician, so I'm already side-eyeing this guy skeptically, so I was impressed by the work that they did do.
They become magicians, Kim, so that they can debunk the fakers.
Yeah, that's why Houdini. If you want to know more about him, he did like an AMA on Reddit, Ask Me Anything about paranormal investigations. But he also seems to, from what I can tell, do like press junkets of that movie franchise Paranormal Activity and like talk about the legitimacy of it. So that's kind of weird.
Yeah. Once in a while, our library will have like a paranormal investigator come in and give like a little a little talk. It's always funny. I went once like 100 years ago, but it's a fun thing to do. And before we go on to the next thing, I watched this segment with my son who's 12 and he's always been afraid of like going on haunted ghost tours and stuff like that. He's finally over it. So
nice.
When we visit Lancaster in the next week or so, we are going to go on one of their haunted ghost tours. And he said, well, can you, like, stay at these places? And I said, yes. I've been waiting for this day.
Honestly. So, yeah, thank you, Julia, and thank you, Robert Stack.
Yeah, I think it really, thankfully, the New Mexico Jews have brought a new a new thing for us to do in our family.
So, oh, wow.
But my wife hates all this stuff and she just rolls her eyes like you do. But
Well, I can't wait to hear and I hope you'll keep us updated if you see any ghosts or how that whole experience went. But for now.
Now we got to get on a jet and fly down to Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. And our time machine is going back to March 7th, 1988, where a car is found on fire in a very isolated part of San Juan, Puerto Rico. And the next morning, the authorities find the, quote, remains of a body, but it seems like all that remains is a jaw fragment and four loose teeth.
Now, we talked about, did you... bless you, I think, right?
Thank you, yes.
maybe a dog barked. no, so we, this whole thing is very strange because all that's left, and they even said there's ash, all that's left in the ash is a jawbone and four loose teeth, which just, we've talked about cremations and the process of it, and you need temperatures of up to 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit in order to bring a body to ash for hours. So
exactly.
I don't know. I don't know if I'm buying that a car fire could have done that without some type of igniter. Not igniter, but something to sustain the fire.
Yeah, it seems like there should have been a charred skeleton, not just, like, literally, like, loose teeth. So a week later, an informant tells authorities that the body is that of, like, infamous ringleader of multimillion dollar drug ring, John Scott Rubis. And he has, like, a monopoly on the coke and weed distribution in the Midwest of the United States. We're talking, like, Chicago, Wisconsin, all these places. They said in 4 years, he snuck in an estimated $30 million worth of drugs into the United States.
And that's 30 years ago money. So that's
yeah.
Ridiculous amount of money this guy was having. You just, I don't know. You have bodyguards at that kind of wealth, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say so. And they kind of show us how he is like trafficking in kilos and kilos of coke from these little planes from like the Bahamas, Panama, all these places, go to Puerto Rico. And then from there, he goes to like Chicago.
Now, so let me just ask you, in your opinion, when they showed the planes flying over, did you feel like that footage was also maybe, you know, wow, Puerto Rico looks really beautiful? Like, I kind of got this whole thing where Unsolved Mysteries was kind of putting on the plate how kind of organized and I don't know. They didn't really turn him into this horrible kingpin. They really kind of glorified it a bit, I thought.
Interesting.
The footage is beautiful, though.
It was beautiful. I mean, it looks exactly like you'd think, like just a tropical paradise.
And three planes just kind of gliding over. You're like, oh, I wish I was in that plane with all that cocaine.
With 250 kilos of cocaine. But it's rumored that maybe he, like, faked his death because at this time, the feds are closing in on this guy. And all of the people of his little operation have been arrested except for him. And so then all of a sudden, his little bits of his body are found burned up. They even brought in like dental records and they were like, oh yeah, these are his four teeth. Like, I don't understand how that works.
Yeah. How did they, I don't know. They shipped it or they maybe made molds.
I mean, that I can understand like how they would get teeth to Puerto Rico. But like what I don't understand is like normally with a dental records, you're looking at like the pattern of all the teeth together. Do they have an overbite? Do they have an underbite? How is their like left molar? You know, stuff like that. So with just four loose teeth, I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I don't know if also four teeth would determine it, really.
Exactly.
I mean, have you ever taken an impression of your teeth where they create the mold? And with the new thing, I mean, this is obviously has nothing to do with this, but now they do 3D rendering of the mouth. So now I'm guessing that the technology has evolved even more. But yeah, four teeth, does that kind of equate to really identifying somebody?
I don't know, but apparently it's good enough for them. They think it's him, but you know, it is Unsolved Mysteries, so we're like,
good
maybe
enough.
It's not. Yeah, so we get to have an exclusive interview with an ex-associate of Rubis, who Unsolved Mysteries calls Richard. And this guy's like in the shadows, you know, he's just a silhouette. And he's saying he used to rule by fear. He got suspicious that one of the pilots who was flying all the coke and was like running his own operation. So they show him like putting a gun in the guy's mouth and stuff. And then he's like, you can go, but don't let it happen.
What
again.
Is that, though? Because when they really set up that particular scene, they were saying how there was one particular incident. And it's like, you're thinking, oh, this is going to be an incident that ends with blood. But it doesn't. He just goes, you better stop doing what you're doing, buddy. Big, you know, and it's like, all right, punch out, go home.
Yeah. And the guy, like, even the guy's like, Am I cool? Like, can I go? So it took like investigators all these years to close in on him. We get these kind of cool surveillance photos of the whole compound. And in December of 1987, just 4 months before his body was found, is when authorities charged 37 members of the ring.
Wow.
So in the U.S., charges were dropped against him because the car is found. And in Puerto Rico, authorities found out that former Rubis associate Donald Kurtzer had a vendetta against Rubus and ordered the hit. And why did he have a vendetta, you ask? Because Rubus allegedly was killed in retaliation for raping Kurtzer's girlfriend and the 14-year-old daughter of Kurtzer's housekeeper.
Yeah, this is more in line with the kind of people that I expected to be in this segment. And,
yeah,
you know, as usual, Unsolved Mysteries truly doesn't disappoint bringing these characters to light. Not just characters, yeah, but legitimate people who did these terrible things.
And I lived for this reenactment. So he gets off the plane and he is like sloshed and two girls meet him there and they're like, hey, baby, how's it going? He's got one arm on each of them. I'm sure he's like railed on coke and he's just like, hey, let's go. Where are we going? They're like, get in the car, baby. It's cool. So then they drive out and they're like, we have a little errand to run. And so he's like, well, where are we? It's like a terrible car, too.
It's like a LeBaron or something.
Well, I mean, that's how you go undetected, I guess.
Yeah, but that's a good point.
The women were like, we got an errand to run. We just have to run to the middle of the desert, like, real quick. So they do, and he's, like, drunk as hell in the back of the car, and the girls get and run out, and then that's supposedly where he shot and lit on fire. So a few months after that, Richard, the guy who's, like, in the shadows, says that he received a phone call from Rubus. Now, small world here. This is so crazy. Assistant U.S. attorney talks to us on Unsolved Mysteries.
I cannot believe that this came out. Like, this is, I've not heard this said anywhere else. This is like an exclusive Unsolved Mysteries Rewind.
I love that. So the guy who's like in charge of all this is Assistant U.S. attorney Paul Cantor. Now, crazy coincidence. Paul Cantor is the attorney in the trial against the outlaw members that we talked about in the last episode with Margie Jelovic and Jaeger, Mad Jaeger, they called him. And he's the guy who was doing those indictments. So it's just like, whoa, what a trip. Because we just did that last episode. It was so bizarre.
Paul Cantor has quite a list of interesting clients. I'm sure you saw them as well. He tends to get involved with a lot of different things. And I have to wonder if he's going to be popping up in the future and we just haven't noticed yet.
Yeah, probably. Like Paul Renfro, like on all the episodes. So one of the drug dealer ring members' wives says that she also got a call from Rubus. And they show him, like, I'm guessing in Florida, there's palm trees behind him wearing this like fake beard, using a payphone and wearing like a fanny pack and stuff. He looked like he was in Weekend at Bernie's or something.
Yeah, it was and silly.
And he's calling them. So I don't know. People say that it's him. Meanwhile, people are serving time for the murder of him. No. I will say the coolest thing I've ever heard is from quote unquote Richard, who says, bottom line is John Rubus still rides.
Now, if I were to be asked, like, all right, which one do you believe more? Tupac is alive or Rubus? I would say Rubus has a better chance of being alive. Mm-hmm. Probably had more money, too.
Yeah, less, I don't even know how you call it, but I think he could lay low better. But I mean, those coke eyes, though, there is no hiding those. Oh, my God. Every picture of him, he just had like the whitest eyes you've ever seen. But we do learn that DNA matched the jawbone to the teeth of John Rubus. So as far as investigators are concerned, this case is closed.
Are they sure those weren't baby teeth?
Well, that's interesting. They did say that they think that he's even capable of like pulling his own teeth out and putting him in the car, which is crazy.
Well, but think about it. You're on the run, right, Kim? You need to go underground. Are you willing to lose a couple teeth that are probably rotting out of your head anyway because of, you know, all the grinding you're doing because of all the coke?
Totally. Yeah, totally. No, oh my God. I mean, it seems like a small price to pay, but
right?
I mean,
yeah.
But then would I give up a piece of my jawbone? That seems harder to achieve.
Is it possible? All right. This is super, super conspiratorial. This is like what we should refer to as the tinfoil hat moment.
Love it.
Is it possible he had a type of a cancer or something and he had to have part of his jaw removed?
And that's why he was wearing the fake beard.
Yeah. You made that connection. I didn't make that connection. But think about it.
Okay. He's possible.
I mean, we've seen the unfortunate photographs of I'm forgetting his name, the person who reviews movies before he passed away. He had part of his jaw removed.
Ebert.
Yeah. And it was always, a lot of people don't like him or anything. I personally like him a lot, but to see those photos of him, it's shocking. And
oh, yeah.
But if he has the thing on, you know, the mask, the beard, you never know. Anyway, again, it's a tinfoil moment. Take off your tinfoil hats as we head out to L.A. Although there might be moments where you might need to put on that tinfoil hat again. But you know what? Nobody can put on the tinfoil hat. Well, only a few people can.
There's this really, speaking of like things to put on your noggin, we go to 1846 in like Mexico, which is later going to become Los Angeles. This woman was wearing, and I've seen it before, I was trying to find exactly what it's called, but it's this like lifted veil that I feel like I've seen Mexican women wear in like the 1700s, the 1800s. I loved it. I would absolutely work it into my everyday wardrobe. Like, it is so beautiful. But basically, the Mexican-American War is raging and closing in. So all these, like, richy riches who lived in what's now Los Angeles buried their family fortunes for safekeeping. So we meet Dr. Roy Roche, who is a treasure expert. And apparently in 1984, two women hired him to look for this treasure, which is supposedly buried in what's now the Elysian Park in Los Angeles. So they heard stories in their whole childhood about the buried treasure. And I feel like Unsolved Mysteries kind of shades the two sisters a little bit because they say, like, the women claimed they had permits, but they would only dig at night. Like, I don't know. It seemed, and they even said on Unsolved Mysteries, like, it's almost impossible to get a permit to dig, like, this national park. It's on the historic register because it's the oldest park in Los Angeles.
That was, like, my question. I wasn't sure if it was an old park. But yeah, you're saying that it's been a park for a very long time.
Since the 1700s, since 1769, this park was established. And it's like a 575-acre park. It's one of those things where it's like, you do not think you're in the city anymore. Right. It looks gorgeous.
Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't, actually.
Me either. I'm just... But what we do is, you know, we do get a guy who's been digging around. He seems to see things that... maybe there or might not be there. He finds initials carved, allegedly carved in a rock. It's basically an O and a C, right? And he also sees three indentations, which may or may not be natural or man-made. Like, it just, these are things where it's like, well, you got to make a decision here. Like, you have to choose a side a little bit, right? And he doesn't. And those initials didn't look like initials to me. Those I mean, they even had to superimpose the O and the C over it to go like, if you squint. You know, they did find evidence of an old tunnel, which.
Yeah. So like halfway between these two rocks that you were just describing, there is an old tunnel. And he says, quote, it was not an old toilet pit. Just disgusting. Oh,
I never want to find an old toilet pit. I mean, I'm assuming a toilet. I don't know. I've never heard of the term, but I'm assuming it's like. A cesspool, like a man-made, I guess like a hole that was tank. A cesspool that you would just dump in. I don't know.
And it was spoken like someone who has come across his fair share of toilet pits in the past.
Dude, you're in another toilet pit.
Oh, damn it.
But look, batteries. So he keeps digging, and that's what he finds. And you can see when he talks about these two old flashlight batteries that he finds, because he keeps digging, and he's also his metal detector is finding something. So he's seeking it out. And he finally digs down 25 feet and he uncovers two old flashlight batteries. And I think that this is his thing where he's like, and that's all I found. Like, he dug a little bit deeper. He found an old rope and that was his whole haul.
Yeah, no, but it was like a big rope. To be fair, this rope was probably like 6 inches.
Yeah, it was like a boat rope or something.
Yeah, but he was like, oh, you know what this means? Like, anytime you find old cutoff rope and two old batteries, somebody's been here before and they cleared out all the treasure.
Or...
did they?
Or he's just giving up because the ladies aren't paying anymore.
I mean, I'm sure he doesn't come cheap. He's a doctor. I don't know in what, but he still thinks that there is treasure approaching $1 million somewhere in the park.
And this makes me think that he is after something. He knows something more than what everyone is talking about. Or
yeah.
A group of them are like, you know, going after. And it does remind me a little bit of Goonies.
Yeah. It was really funny because, I don't know, I think it's really cool, not funny, that Unsolved Mysteries hires this this operation called NUMA, which is like National Underwater Marine Academy, something like that, sorry. And they hire the people to come do ground penetrating radar to see if there is, because Unsolved Mysteries can't get the permit to dig.
But how did they get the permit to even do this? It's, you know, like metal detecting and all this stuff, as far as I know, is you can't even obtain permits to do it. I mean, because why do it if you can't dig? And it's just one of those kind of weird things.
But I don't know. They did have that guy from like Los Angeles District Parks and Rec that was out there. Yeah, and he had like kind of was keeping an eyeball on everything, so maybe it was cool. And you know, again, maybe this is tourism Los Angeles. Like maybe they were like, okay, you can do it because it's going to bring people to the park.
And you know, I kind of like the technology. I like the idea of the ground penetrating radar or whatever it was that they were doing. It looked like kind of like a cheese slice, like a big cheese slice that they drag across the ground, shooting God knows what kind of X-rays into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing, you know, I do have a question. So they buried these, you know, these treasures and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I looked for so long to see if I could find an answer to this, and I still have not found it. Mm. If I were to bury something, even a coffin, I'm kind of curious about. Being that there are earthquakes very often on the West Coast, is it possible that these things can shift very easily, or even what are those called? The pits that open in the middle of nowhere,
like fault line. Oh, well, like there sinkholes.
Like a sinkhole. Now, sinkholes very often because of underwater rivers and water that dissolves salt deposits, and that when the salt dissolves, it opens up this huge empty void, and then the ground collapses into it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just throwing it out there, it's possible this stuff is forever lost because of earthquakes and you know, shifting the ground underneath. Just throwing it out there. It's just, but they did find a few things that might be something underground.
Yeah, supposedly. I mean, it was cool technology, but I couldn't make out heads or tails from the graphs that they showed us.
Right. They just circle something. I'm like, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, they're like, this is definitely a metal object under there. And it's like, okay, well, maybe it's like an old miner throwing their bean can down there, you know, from like 49ers. I don't know what it is.
So. Damn it, more batteries.
I know, exactly. So, another toilet pit. But
not another toilet pit. But I also felt like Unsolved Mysteries wanted to find something. Like something for real.
Yeah. Finders keepers. I'm pretty sure they get splitsies, but like
splitsies.
Robert Stack leaves us and is like, just so you know, it's super illegal to come out here and dig without a permit. So you will get in trouble if you try it, which I thought was kind of funny.
But if you look really close, he winks. No, he doesn't. So I'm just kind of, you know, right now in California, it's so heated. I'm kind of curious. You could probably just go there and do whatever you want.
Yeah, it's just total martial law. It's anarchy out there.
Yeah, I'm going to fly out to California, and what I'm going to do is I'm not going to riot. I'm not going to yell in the streets. I'm going to start digging.
Right on.
No, I'm not. Well, batteries. I don't need more batteries. So flying over the Atlantic to Germany. Mm-hmm. This is the story that involves Siegfried and Marguerite Lyre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they are coming on Unsolved Mysteries through a translator to tell us that they are searching for an American soldier who Siegfried bonded with in childhood. And this is actually a pretty sweet story, but then we uncover something that might not be as sweet.
It ruins it a little bit for me, but because I don't buy it, right? But it's so funny that I have to kind of have this fiction in the back of my head.
And I've been saying the last line, which we'll get to, but I've been saying that to Jack pretty much every single day since I read it. So in 1945, little baby Siegfried's home is destroyed by Allied bombers. He's a little German boy, and his mom like straps him to her back, and all the other little kids rounds up and they start hiking for their relative's house. Mm. It's 125 miles away to go live with the relatives.
Jeez.
So, yeah, I know. They are tough, man.
Yeah, I mean, we do see a little bit, you know, we get a little bit of a backstory. Of course, 1945, things are extremely tense right now in their area. Unfortunately, they weren't able to escape. And it's just everything sucks there right now.
Yeah, they said that they were on, like, food stamps, like, ration stamps, yeah. And that they never had enough food to eat. Life was super rough. And then, all of a sudden, these American troops come rolling in, and everyone at first is, like, terrified that the big, bad Americans are going to come wipe them out. But, well, apparently...
You know, I'm sorry if I could just interrupt you for a second. I mean, the Germans also sold a lot of propaganda, saying that the Americans are the enemy. I mean, well, you know what? I mean, with... The bottom line is the Americans... were the enemy. It's just a matter of, you know, in the big picture, in the big scheme of things, the Americans were trying to do the better of the two evils. And, or the big evil. So when they come in, it's like these terrible Americans are going to round up all Germans and kill us, you know? And it's just one of those things where, of course, I'm just kind of curious, you know, one thing I have not looked into is if there was any type of outpour of aggression from the public towards the Americans.
I don't know.
Really sure.
I mean, think about this. He's in this town because the Allied troops bombed his house. Like you said, he is subject to propaganda. This kid's like five. This is all he knows.
Yeah.
I could imagine it'd be terrifying to see these big jeeps and convoys of guys.
It's terrifying to see our own. Like being, you know, here seeing American soldiers, it is terrifying. But to go through all that, I would never want that for anybody. Even people I don't like, Kim.
And then there was some... Well, in here we get a really nice soldier named Alexander, and he kind of... The reenactments are so freaking cute in this one. And he sees, like, little Siegfried hiding, and he's like, "You want some chocolate, little boy?" And the guy, and little Siegfried comes up. He's like, "Say chocolate." He's like, "Chocolate." He's like, "Take this chocolate and run back to your family, and you share it with them." And he's like, "Oh my God, I love you." So... later on, Alexander, the army guy, comes over with this big tub of soup, and he comes and he brings it over specifically for little Siegfried, who he kind of like just loved at first glance. And in the reenactment, Siegfried's like crawling all on him, taking his hat and wearing it. Like, it's
yeah,
so
I thought this
cute.
At this point, I was like, this guy's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and Siegfried said, like, he was my guardian angel. Our days of hunger were over because he always, like, took food from the army rations, the army mess tent, and brought it to us so we could eat.
Because the Americans, of course, probably had a billion tons of food. Like, I mean, that's another thing, you know, that we need, that the Americans needed to bring after all of this happened, is they basically need to to feed literally everybody. As well as they possibly could with the, you know, handing it out slowly, but... taking, you know, having this guy actually take an interest in a family and give them a little bit extra, I think is just really, really nice. It's
and
really
like,
sweet.
Beyond that, he would like take Siegfried to kindergarten in his Jeep, and he would be like, "Hey, you want to drive it?" So Siegfried's like holding on to the steering wheel, and he's like, "You're doing it, Ziggy, you're doing it.
Light my cigarette." You know?
Yeah, exactly. And he's like teaching him English this whole time, and it seems like they are just really good buddies. So suddenly it's time to roll out. Like, they got to go. You know, they can't just live here and let the kid drive the Jeep forever. So they had to part. Luckily, in the spring of 1945, Siegfried was able to take a photo with Alexander. And so we get to see the photo. It's
when I saw the photo, it got to me, actually. That's where I was like, oh, man, he looks like a really nice guy and this kid. Oh.
And also, like, this welcome in context later, we didn't say it, but Alexander's African-American.
Right.
Which I'm sure that you're probably not seeing a lot of in Nazi-occupied Germany. So that's another reason why maybe Siegfried would have initially been like maybe even scared as a 5-year-old. I don't really know. But Alexander, we learn he was like approximately 20 at the time, and we're searching for him. And Siegfried says, "I just want to like talk to this guy. I just want to be reunited with this guy." He was part of a regime that marched into Marlebach, Germany on March 27, 1945, and they stayed at the Grunenbaum guest house.
Grunenbaum.
So we don't really get an update on Unsolved Mysteries. A fun fact is the actor who played Alexander is in a ton of stuff now. He's in Dexter.
That's crazy.
Yeah, he plays Spartan in like this on the CW with their like comic book thing. So like on The Flash, on those kinds of you know, like teen superhero mm-hmm. movies. He's in there. His name's David Ramsey, and he has a pretty prolific IMDb. But, okay.
This is where things get a little bit more twisted. This is the tinfoil hat moment, maybe.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we never say this is true or not. We're just giving you all the information that we have gathered from the internet. So, on Unsolved.com, those lunatics in the comments are pretty certain that the soldier is either Alexander Bell or Alexander Whitfield. So I'm going to read in its entirety this comment on there, which it hurts a little bit, but only if you take it completely but seriously.
You know what's interesting is this is a, I was totally into it, and then it was like a little zinger at the end. So,
I know, right?
So listen up, people.
So he says, this guy says, Alexander Whitfield was his name. This was my dad's friend back in the army, and they were assigned to handing out food to German families after the fall of Nazi Germany. When you showed that picture on TV, that was Whitfield for sure. He stole soup from the army mess hall to take it to this family because he had taken a liking to little Ziegfeld's mother. They would find the Hausfrau and feed them after knocking them up so that they would think that they were just getting fat instead of knocked up. He died in 1991 of cancer, but he was hosing your mom, little Ziggy.
Oh, jeez.
I have said that to Jack, I'm telling you, every day of my life. He was hosing your mom, little Ziggy. It's so harsh. And somebody even commented, like, damn, dude, you didn't need to be that blunt.
Right. Like, you know, it's like everything else was nice. It's almost like you were drinking during the comment and got to the end. Yeah. It was starting to kick in. I don't know. Ooh. It was just one of those things where, I don't know. Maybe it's true.
Maybe it's true. But here's why I brought up that he's African-American. Would Ziegfeld not know that he had a half-black sibling?
Well, we don't know when his mother passed away. We don't have a lot of details about all of that.
Yeah, but I mean, the baby would have been like 6 years younger than him. Oh, because right, we know that yeah. he was five then. It's not like through her whole life. It was like during this very specific period of time. So I feel like if she was knocked up, I mean, she might have been getting hosed, knocked but maybe up. If she was knocked up, then I think that he would know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't imagine there's a lot of African Americans in Moerlenbach, Germany in 1945 is all I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of unanswered questions here. We don't know. Did he remain in Germany? Like, you know, these, you know, it was still a terrible place to live for so long.
Oh yeah.
It's now it's great. No, not right now, but I mean, you know, they of course rebuild and, you know, it's a really great place, but I don't know. It's a weird story. And maybe it would have even been illegal enough to put the whole family in jail.
Ooh, excellent segue. Yeah. We get an update from a story that was originally from season 6, episode 3, but this takes us to Annawan, Illinois.
Yeah. This is a weird one. There's a photograph that, We're shown almost immediately where we see a family in a jail cell.
Yeah, and we'll post it on Unsolved Mysteries because it is crazy, or on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind podcast on Facebook.
We have a mom with another 7 kids. You know, like this is like one of these things, a lot of friggin' kids. But in 1948, where you found out it was right before December 3rd, Hilda Krohn and her 7 kids were evicted from their home, sadly enough. And there were no places for them to go. There were no shelters. This is 1948. This is, you know, this post-war.
In like small town Illinois. And apparently it's not like it was even that great because I read an article that said their home had no plumbing, no heating. And every night the children cramped into a single bed for warmth.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of kids, a lot of warmth, hopefully. But I mean, it sucks. You know, that totally sucks. So, the county apparently took some pity on them because they said, look, we can't do much for you, even though like we're evicting you from this home. Why don't you just stay at the jail? And it had to be a weird conversation, right?
Yeah. Like, honestly, where?
You going to lock us in? You know,
there's an episode of Andy Griffith's show. It's like the Christmas special where the dad's in jail and they want to let him out for Christmas, but this guy is like harping on them that they can't. So they arrest the kids and the mom. And so they can all spend Christmas together. And that's what it reminded me of.
Sounds like a Republican move right there.
Oh, we're getting political.
No, not really political. It's just more of a jab.
Oh, okay.
No, but it does sound the kind of, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, fine, well, arrest everybody. You know? So, there are only shelters in a jail. I don't know if they got 3 square meals and some, you know, outdoor time, but I'm laughing, but it's hard. It's terrible. It really is.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad, and it gets worse. So on December 17th of 1948, a newspaper ran an article about the family staying in the jail, because that's a pretty good story. This is a very unusual thing. I can't imagine it happens very often.
Nowadays, there would be, a GoFundMe or something.
Yeah, exactly. And a bunch of readers reached out and were like, I'll adopt the kids. I'll take that one. I'll take the tall one, whatever. So right. Eventually, eventually the kids were all separated and put up for adoption and or foster care. And this is where it gets a little shady, because I read an article that a social worker said that they were going to take the children to live at foster homes just for the holidays so that they would get presents.
Yeah.
And then they just never returned them. So a lot of people, including Marie, who's one of the daughters, think that the mom did not consent to giving them away and was just kind of tricked.
Yeah, I wonder if it's like once they are there, like I bet you that there was a law. I'm going to almost guarantee it. As soon as the orphanage has the children in their possession, they can determine what happens to the children.
It's no take backsies.
Maybe. Again, no take backsies.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think it's something along those lines. Mm-hmm. I bet
you're right.
Prove me wrong.
Well, 18 years later, siblings Marie, who we previously mentioned, and Raymond found each other, and they're like, we are going to find the rest of our siblings. So in 1993, they find Sister Carol. In 1994, the story airs on Unsolved Mysteries. And within hours of the broadcast, everybody was found.
It's beautiful. I love that kind of thing, because it really, we get to the world of technology. You know, it's like almost like what Facebook used to be great when Facebook was useful. Like you find people that you actually wanted to find, and people that you wanted to find you found you, but then the other weirdos found you too. And
true. Yeah.
This is what they sought out to do. And with the technology of national television, they were able to find each other. And I just love that.
I know. So on July 9th of 1994, Unsolved Mysteries cameras are there as everybody is reunited for the first time in almost 50 years.
It's crazy.
So, grab the tissues, because this is like very emotional. They're like clinging on to each other, and they're like, you're going to get sick of me hugging you by the end of this. And the guy's like, I'll never get sick of you hugging me. Like, oh,
and they preface really it by Unsolved Mysteries was there for the reunion. I was thinking when they first said that, I'm like, Robert Stack's going to pull up in a limo. Why didn't he? Why doesn't he show up in some of these? It would be so amazing.
It would. Yeah. No, I don't know. I never thought about it until you said it. And now it feels like it's lacking. But
yeah, you could have given her a lei. That would make more sense.
Yeah. She's wearing a lei, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but
makes no sense.
That the mom, Hilda, died in 1977, but she had 3 more kids after her 7 were ripped from her.
Wow.
So my God, 11 children. Kids.
Oh no.
10.
3 more. I'm sorry. Yeah. Math is hard, but 10 children, that is really, really aggressive.
My God.
That's like 8, that's nearly 9 years, let's just say, of being pregnant. Like a decade of being pregnant.
Yeah.
No constantly.
Thanks. Yeah, there's no twins or anything in that mix, by the way. So these are all like single pregnancies. And yeah, I don't know. Bummer. I mean, this it was kind of a bummer, kind of sweet that they got to see each other. A couple of the siblings have since died, but, at least they got to see each other again.
Yeah, we get, from time to time, we get the twin thing, we get the orphanage thing, and we do see more often than not the reunions happening. And I think that's really nice.
Yeah, they don't want to show us the non-reunions. I mean, remember adopted son of Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, Francis Murphy, died when they showed him, sadly riding the orphan train all by himself. So they're definitely not as feel-good, but they're out there.
But remember, this originally started out as not having a conclusion.
True.
So, putting it out there is risky. It's kind of like, well, we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are 25 years later, and... sometimes we find that, I'm wondering how often they get updated. That's something we were talking about a little bit about the Unsolved Mysteries episodes that we watch. Some of them are updated up until just a couple years ago.
even this year. I mean, the one that we did with Laura Bible and Ashley Freeman was updated from stuff from this year. So I don't know.
What kind of team do they have working for them?
I don't know.
But by this point, the Netflix season 2 will have already been released. And I hope the people who are listening to this enjoyed whatever we ended up doing about it. I'm talking to you from the past or the future. But I am excited to watch that. And I hope you are too.
Yeah.
But Kim, as always, thank you so much for getting together for this episode. It was a weird one because it's really it's a lot of belief systems going on.
Yeah, exactly. Hard to find some like facts out about this case, but it was worth watching. I'm glad we covered it.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.